And now, Linda Strasberg, interviews and interactions on K-Talk.
Hello, I have a program for you that is going to set your mind straight, and no pun intended. We're going to talk about how your feelings are linked to the brain, the body, and the sixth sense. The name of the book is The Spiritual Anatomy of Emotion. Like when people collaborate, they come up with new ways of thinking about old thoughts and old beliefs, and the capacity of both of their minds and their intelligence and their experience and their research all comes together and creates something new and a new perspective. I've always been really fascinated about the mind-body-feeling connection and the sixth sense, and this book combines it all together. It's probably one of the most fascinating books I've read in a very, very long time. My first guest, he's on the air right now. We're trying to get the other author on. My first guest is Michael Jauer. He's an emotion researcher and expert on sick building syndrome. He lives in Virginia. And then the other author is Mark S. McCosey, MD, PhD. He's an adjunct professor of physiology and biophysics at Georgetown University. And he edited the first U.S. alternative medicine textbook, which I think is wonderful. I like to know that they have alternative medicine textbooks out there for the doctors to see. And he lives in Maryland. And we're trying to get Dr. McCosey on. Our guest right on the line right now is Michael Jauer. So I want to welcome to the program Michael Jauer. Welcome to the program.
It's a true pleasure to be with you.
Am I getting your name right?
Yes, indeed.
Oh, good. Okay. I always like to make sure I'm doing that.
Appreciate that.
I have been reading your book, and it is phenomenal because it takes all these sciences that are happening now in the world that people are looking at, the feelings, energy, paranormal, all these things that everybody's interested in and coming to believe in, whereas they didn't maybe 15 years ago. Some of them were kind of edgy and woo-woo and New Age stuff, and this is kind of, your book combines them together into a scientific mode. And so I'd like you to share with us the genesis of this book and why you collaborated with Dr. McCosey.
Sure. And as you say, Mark is really one of the pioneers in complementary and alternative medicine. His experience goes back good 25, 30 years. He's widely published, much more so than I am, but I was very fortunate to meet up with him because he has really the medical background that I don't, but my background is quite different, and like what you're saying about collaborations, I think we've sort of complemented one another because our backgrounds are so different, but our interests are similar. And the way this all started, Linda, was about 15 years ago, I was working in the commercial real estate industry, and I was developing indoor air quality guidance for building owners and managers. You may have heard of sick building syndrome, the idea that it's a fact that people sometimes will get sick in buildings, and then when they go home, they get outside of the building, they get out in the fresh air, they feel better. And so there's something about the building, apparently in those cases, that causes people to get sick. Mm-hmm. So obviously this is a concern not only to the people who are feeling ill and to their employers in the buildings, but ultimately to the building owners and the building managers and building engineers who are responsible for operating, maintaining a clean, well-operated a building. And so nobody really wants these complaints to come about. So we were developing guidance for use in commercial buildings. And I was talking to a whole lot of folks who were responsible for the upkeep and maintenance of buildings and learning a lot that way about the physical infrastructure of buildings. And then talking to some of the people who felt they'd been affected by and sidelined by sick building syndrome or by poor indoor air quality is maybe a different way to put it. And I realized talking to them that the problem may not be in all cases with the building itself, but the interaction of the atmosphere in the building, let's say, elements of the building with the particular people. Because oftentimes it was just a handful of people in a given situation that were complaining and felt they'd really been affected, had headaches or cold or flu-like symptoms, lethargy, feeling debilitated, things like that. And in many cases, people said that they'd been sensitive, if you will, to various and sundry things and situations throughout their life, that that particular building or that office environment was just the latest in sort of a series of occurrences or times that they felt that they'd been affected in some way that really set them back. And so I got to thinking, well, perhaps they're more sensitive in a sort of biological way, look at it that way. And then also some of the people told me that they were sensitive in quite different ways than I'd expected. Some people said it's not just these sick building type of symptoms, but I've been sensitive to chemicals for a long time. If I'm around paints, pesticides, even colognes, perfumes, cleaning agents, solvents, things like that, it really just throws me for a loop. Other people said, I've been sensitive for a long time to electricity. The local library won't let me in because the catalog system, electronic catalog, goes hooey when I'm nearby and things of that nature, which got me wondering, what the heck is going on? Are folks kind of making this up? Is it some kind of hypochondria? And then the kicker was that some people said that they had been sensitive psychically as well, and that in tandem with allergies and things of that nature, they felt they could read emotional energies from people. They felt presences. They could see auras and things of that nature. And ultimately, I wondered whether this might not be something other than mental illness and people making things up, but rather that they might legitimately be sensitive to a whole slew of things from way back into their childhood. And maybe there are some genetics implicated here, and there's a super sensitive kind of person that's just reacting to things at a very low threshold, more so than most other people.
Mm-hmm. You have the first chapter in your book as about emotions, like the definition of emotions, putting emotion in a new light. So you're studying these sensitivities and how they manifest in different people. I relate to the one about sensing people and the electrical. I relate to that one the best. And then they create these different emotions and sensitivities and feelings. Can you thread that, what you just told us, into the emotional and feelings aspect, how it manifests?
Right. Well, the emotion framework came about later as I was investigating the sensitivities. It seemed like the common denominator, Linda, for a lot of this was how people felt. It wasn't that they were sort of had an existential problem with being in a particular place. It was how they were literally feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Migraine is one form of sensitivity that's characteristic of super sensitive people or highly sensitive people. And when someone is getting a migraine, they know when it's coming on. They feel it coming on. They feel quite a bit different as the migraine hits, and it's very debilitating. One interesting thing about migraine is that it can be set off by strong feelings, and in particular by feelings that people don't often realize that they're having. They might be in an argument or getting into an argument with a spouse or someone close to them. They may be recollecting a tumultuous time in their life. They might be sort of relating a situation where they got into an argument with somebody, and then the migraine will come on. And so it can actually be triggered by feelings. And realizing that, I started to think about how feelings could sort of be a common denominator and mixed in with these types of sensitivities, that when people present some symptoms, that there are there's something going on biologically and neurologically that's part and parcel of how we feel. So that ended up being a very useful framework to explore all of this, because as you pointed out at the top of the show, the more science learns about human beings, the more we realize through the science that it's not just the brain sort of barking out intellectual orders to the rest of the body. The whole body is involved in how we feel, and how we feel underlies how we think and what we experience.
And I view it, based on some of the reading in your book, that it's like a big circulation, like you've taken these things from the atmosphere and outside, and you separated from electrical and other aspects coming into your body. You're sensing those. It moves around in your body and is translated, let's say, and then it manifests in feelings. And you say feelings may literally be at the center of who we are. So we convert those sensitivities from the outside into who we are. Am I getting that right?
Yes, that's very well said, especially because the book is about 500 pages and it covers a lot, and you've really crystallized it there for people. That is the bottom line, and the fact is that we think of ourselves as antennas, if you will. We're taking in information from the environment all the time. Wherever you are, wherever I am, your listeners, there's stuff going on. There's light, there's sound, there's the temperature. There's movement of air, there's humidity, there may be vibration in the room. There's a whole lot of things going on that the body is taking account of, and that awareness may not all be conscious, but it's sensory stimuli that are coming into the body, and some of that will come to awareness if it's particularly uncomfortable in the room or there's something in your body that is just sort of flagging you, saying, your stomach is rumbling, or you've got sort of an itch, or your back is aching, or you've got to stretch your legs, something like that. Then it becomes conscious, but we're feeling all the time. We're sentient. We're taking in sensory information. And before we have thoughts, generally, before we have thoughts, we have a sensory awareness, and the feelings very often are behind the thoughts. We act on things because we feel a certain way, and then we decide, well, this is what we're going to do. But it's very often predicated on feeling. And the other thing that's interesting is that as we look at the biology of people and the evolution of human beings, the feeling brain, it's called the limbic system, the different structures in the brain having to do with feeling, they're much older than the neocortex, the thinking brain, the imagining brain, the deciding brain. So we've got all this great neural apparatus, but it's sort of it's on top of the more primitive feeling brain, and that has much more to do with basic a basic sense of ourselves as to how well we're doing and what we ought to do next.
Mm-hmm. So the we have these sensories, they come in, we have a feeling, and then you say an emotion is a feeling in motion. It's a way of conveying or expressing that feeling that you're having, and you say it may be direct, like talking to someone, or it can be indirect, like writing in a journal, or yelling to no one in particular, but just being upset. And we bury sometimes these emotions, and sometimes we let them out. Is that true?
Yes. The whole thing about emotions is that they're energetic. Anybody who's feeling, which is every one of us listening to this now, everyone has energy associated with their feelings, and the more energetic feelings, you feel like you have to get out there. You're emoting when you feel a certain way. You know, stand up and yell, or you stamp your feet, or you say I love you, or you write something down in a journal. You pace back and forth. You wave your arms. You yell at somebody. Whatever it happens to be, you cry. You laugh. These are all feelings and energy that needs to get out into the world. That's how you convey what you're about at any given moment. And so the energy of those feelings, the E part, and sort of the motion of our feelings is a large focus of the book.
Mm-hmm. And then you talk about how these emotions are manifest is sometimes the same way that we have taken them in. Sometimes they're paranormal, you talk about in the book. Sometimes they are energetic projections of, say, anger, and then sometimes they're depression. They can go a lot of different ways. They're projected back out. So it's like I view it as a big circle. We take this in, we process it, we have the feelings, we have the emotions, and then we project them back out again in various ways that we took them in.
Right, and in general, it's healthy. There's very good scientific evidence that it's healthy generally to get your feelings out when they feel like they need to be expressed, and you've got to express your opinion, or you've got to speak your piece, or you've got to create art. I mean, some of the greatest art ever produced, music, paintings, sculpture, people are moved, literally they're moved because of their feelings to create something remarkable and that's enduring. So a lot of art, probably all of art, really stems from what the artist is feeling. All is very central to our humanity. And the interesting thing about the emotions and the paranormal here, which is an angle I'd never expected I'd necessarily take with this book, but when people who were super sensitive in ways we've talked about, you know, whether it's chronic fatigue, migraine, allergies, fibromyalgia, chronic pain, things of that nature, when some of them said that they perceived energies, as you apparently do, and could see auras and feel presences, I wondered, because those are feelings as well, they feel very strongly sometimes about what they're perceiving. I thought, well, what could there be a connection between these different types of sensitivities? And the more we investigated, Mark and I, we did a survey actually that involved people telling us about their sensitivities and people who weren't sensitive as a control group to sort of compare and contrast. What we ended up concluding, or what we try to demonstrate in the book, is that what's typically called the paranormal, because people don't really understand it, it really is connected very much to what people are feeling. And if they know what they're feeling and they get those feelings out there, there's much less likelihood that anything paranormal is going to be going on. But in many of the situations that we've assessed, it's people who are incapable for one reason or another of expressing very strong feelings. And when the feelings are bottled up, that sort of expresses the potential for something paranormal, depending on who else they're interacting with.
Mm-hmm. So just as a visual for the people out there to know how important this expression of feeling is imagine if we didn't have feelings, then Spock in the Star Trek would exist, because he didn't manifest his feelings. And I just want to put a visual out there, because he didn't have any emotion, and thus he couldn't have any feelings to project. So people would be walking around a lot like Spock on Star Trek if we didn't have that process going on, right?
Well, that's right, but it's interesting that you bring that up, Linda, because there are, for the Star Trek aficionados out there, I mean, there are some of the episodes where it's clear that Spock, because he's half human, has these feelings, but he keeps them bottled up and he keeps them, you know, way down low where they don't ever manifest. But there are some episodes where they come bubbling up, and those are some of the more interesting episodes of Star Trek. He is half human, and what we talk about in the book is that there's a range of personalities, all of them very human, but some people are much more expressive, they're much more aware of what they're feeling, and able to express it, and very reactive. There are 20% of the population are high reactive people. On the other side of the spectrum, 20% of the population are low reactive people. Not a whole lot gets to them, seemingly. Mm-hmm. They take it in, but it doesn't get processed in the same way internally, and so they seem to be much less reactive. And then you have the 60% in between those outer parts of the spectrum. It's all very human, but it's just a matter of different people with different ways of processing and understanding their feelings.
Mm-hmm. As this process is going on, you have in your book that your body contains 100,000 billion cells, and then you have, and they are networked with hundreds of, or even thousands of others. We can see that the process of harnessing energy is extremely complex. So we have this energy going on in our bodies, a very complicated, complex system of energy, and manifesting that. And I've always been fascinated, Michael, about people that, you know, there's some people that can walk in a room and their energy fills the room, and you can't really put your finger on what that is. I have a grandson like that. I work with some people like that. They come into a room and you can sense that they're there. And it's not necessarily that they're flamboyant or, you know, have big body movements or anything. There's just something about their energy. And when you were speaking about this energy process that's going on in a body, there's some people that are energized, let's put it that way. Can you talk to us about that, this energy that's going on in our body?
Well, it's quite remarkable, isn't it? There are certainly personalities like that who just, you know, light up a room, or sometimes it's not exuberant energy, but you can tell that somebody is down, even if you haven't met them before. They mm-hmm. just, you know, they just seem, from their posture and just whatever else might be going on with them, you just realize that they're they're preoccupied or whatever it happens to be. There's an interesting story that we relate in the book about the Dalai Lama, who, by the way, is very interested in emotions. Feelings and emotions play a big role in Buddhism, and there's Buddhism, even though it's a religion, it's also got a lot of science in it because, especially in the last few years, he and his fellow Buddhist monks have connected up with some emotion researchers, some neuroscientists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison primarily, and they've been hooked up to electrodes, and they do meditation, and they help the scientists understand how it is that they can lower their heart rate and do some rather interesting things physiologically. But they've always been fascinated by emotions because they're so characteristically human, and their religion sort of lends itself to the science of emotion. That's kind of a hot topic right now. Anyway, about the Dalai Lama, he is one of those people that you talk about. That he's very exuberant, apparently. His presence can and does light up a room. And one of the neuroscientists, a guy named Paul Ekman out in California, got to be good friends with the Dalai Lama. And I believe he, or maybe the reporter from the Washington Post who was writing the story, also met the Dalai Lama. One of them, at any rate, had said, "It's remarkable, he's such a warm individual, Dalai Lama. Not just figuratively warm, but when you hold his hands or when he holds your hands in his, you feel this warmth sort of coming from him and making its way into and through your body." And they said it was the most amazing thing that this gentleman, Dalai Lama, has this physical effect, that he's literally a warm-hearted person, mm-hmm. and he conveys that in his very presence. And by the way, he's known to Buddhists as the Kundun, which means the presence. So, like you say, it's fascinating when you look at people. We have these millions upon millions of cells that interact. We take in all the same nutrients. We take in food, light, and that gives us the energy that powers the cells. It's ultimately the sun that enables any life on Earth to be animated and to live and grow. And so you have this constant chatter of communication and it's all electrochemical, and yet you have some personalities, as you say, that are remarkably warm. Other people come off as sort of cold fish, and it's just they're different ends of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you should say that, use the heart in your explanation, because you have in your book that that electrical energy doesn't exist only within the body, but it extends outside of it. And you said, did you know that the heart produces the strongest electrical and magnetic activity of any organ in the body, including the brain? It's 5,000 times more electromagnetically powerful than the brain. And I think that's why so many times when we have emotional ups and downs, we express it through the heart instead of through the brain. It doesn't, like, "You broke my brain." We never say that, but "You broke my heart." We say that, or "I love you with all my heart." We don't say "I love you with all my brain."
Yeah, exactly right. And but if you mentioned that to a neuroscientist today, sort of a standard neuroscience answer would be, "Well, that's all mistaken. That's figurative language. We feel in our brains." It's remarkable to me that the more I looked into this, the more I was boggled by the fact that conventional neuroscience thinks that, think is the operative word, that feelings are created in and manifested primarily in the brain. But if you ask someone, even a neuroscientist, to sort of identify themselves by placing their hand on, their center, who they are, most people, maybe all people, including neuroscientists, will typically put their hand over their chest, over their heart. Nobody that I'm aware of that we've asked that question to has put their hand on their head and said, "This is me up here." Mm-hmm. It's part of them up there. But the heart is really the center of who we are in a variety of ways. We have a better part of a chapter in the book devoted to the heart, and one of the most fascinating and somewhat paranormal topics that we delve into, and again, I say paranormal because it's just not well understood at this point, but people who've received transplants, heart transplants in particular, on occasion, there's a small percentage, I believe it's about 5%, of transplantees seemingly take on the personality characteristics of the donor whose heart it was to begin with. And these are baffling cases, but they're quite remarkable and they're very well documented.
Mm-hmm.
And it really raises the question, what is going on? Could there be some energy associated with the heart that is closely connected with the personality of the person whose heart it was? And what is it about the recipients? What is it about the transplant recipients, since only 5% roughly that report this? Is there something in their nature that makes it manifest these situations where they're the ones who say, well, I all of a sudden have a craving for pizza, or their sex life is remarkably different because they got the heart of a 17-year-old and something like that. And some people wake up in the middle of the night with dreams about being cornered in an alley with someone who's got a gun, and they can't piece that together, and they found out later on that the person whose heart they received was killed in a mugging, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some really interesting stories, and they have to do with the heart. And so, again, it just lends itself to the interpretation. There's much more to us, as you say, than our brains. Our brains are sort of the most conscious, most talkative, you might say, part of who we are. But we feel things most deeply, not with the brain, but with the rest of our body, and in particular, of course, by the heart.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk next about, since we've been talking about energy, what frozen energy is. And you go on to explain what that is, and it's fascinating that we have frozen energy also. We don't always project it out. It freezes.
Right. The situations that we're taking a close look at in the book, and we're not the first ones to look at frozen energy, because there's a whole form of somatic therapy, somatic having to do with the body, and there's a whole range of body therapies that talk about energy that's stuck in the body and needed to get it moving again so the person can feel better. But we may be the first to look at frozen energy or calcified energy in terms of its role in creating what's been termed paranormal occurrences. You're familiar with the fight or flight reaction that people have when they're cornered,
mm-hmm.
when they're in a jam, when there's a threat that's manifested, and it doesn't have to be something violent. I mean, it could be somebody in a car, and there's an accident, a crash all of a sudden. Well, you can't fight it, and you can't flee. You're stuck in your car,
mm-hmm.
And so you scrunch down. And you brace for the impact and that kind of thing. And that's probably a good example of how energy can get stuck, because people who manifest whiplash, that's one interpretation of whiplash, is that they've internalized this energy. They couldn't lash out against the other vehicle, and they couldn't flee the scene because they were stuck in their car. And then days or weeks or months later, they've still got symptoms where... for a variety of reasons, maybe they shouldn't have those symptoms, but they
mm-hmm.
persist. And it's sort of the bracing of the person for the crash and trying to hunker down and deal with it as best you can. In these situations where people can't fight or flee, to us that's the kernel, sort of the origin of what's been called paranormal situations, because that energy is there. Somatic therapists will tell you that it's the second law of energy, is that it's neither, well, it's conserved. Energy is neither gained nor lost. It's if you're in a situation where you've had to react to a threat, the energy has been marshaled. You haven't done anything with it, and so it's sort of just stuck in your body. And it seems in a variety of cases that coincidentally is implicated in paranormal situations where people say, well, something weird's going on, we can't figure it out.
Yeah, poltergeist kind of situations. Or others are PTSD, depression. In your book, you talk a lot of ways, there's a lot of ways that this energy manifests itself sooner or later somewhere.
Yeah, depression may be a little bit different because depression is almost absence of feeling. It's someone who is sort of used to or has adopted a style where they're not reacting to things as they should, or they would probably feel better. Depression is almost anti-feeling, and so it's not really a form of feeling that's stuck
or caught.
It's caught somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's almost the absence of feeling. So I'd say depression is maybe a little different situation. Also, depression can exist in combination with these other types of cases. For example, chronic fatigue that you mentioned. I think you mentioned it, or PTSD. I mean, depression often accompanies these other sensitivities, sometimes because, you know, people, they get depressed because they can't shake the chronic fatigue or they can't shake the PTSD, and so they get down and people say, well, you know, what the heck is the matter with you? You know, get up and live your life, and they can't, and they get depressed. So depression is not the sort of the core experience they're having, but it certainly is something that comes up and mm-hmm. and makes itself known.
So you say that, in your book, you say the point is that emotional energy, just like any other form of energy, can be stored, it can be focused, it can be drained, or it can be liberated. And you have that in your book. It can radiate out to others for better or for ill. It can be felt or left to work on its own in our bodies and our nervous systems, which may result in illness or some other manifestation of this energy. I want to come back. We've been talking this last 40 minutes to the author of the book, the co-author, Michael A. Jauer, along with Mark S. Mikosi, MD and PhD. They wrote this book, The Spiritual Anatomy of Motion. I love this book. We'll be right back.
Linda Strasberg, interviews and interactions on K-Talk. AM 630, KTKK. Interviews and interactions, Linda Strasberg on K-Talk.
Welcome back to the program. We're having a fascinating discussion with one of the authors of the book, The Spiritual Anatomy of Emotion, and Michael A. Jauer is here with me today. Michael, I wanted to ask you, I want to move into the sort of paranormal now that we're talking about this energy, this wonderful energy that we all have. It can be stored, it can be projected out, it can be turned into something good. And I wanted to talk to you about people that have the ability to heal. You share that in your book, and I truly feel that some people have that talent to do that. They have this healing energy. Where do you think that comes from, and where do you think it started from some of the things you've studied?
It's a really good question, and one interesting case in point is some people who've become healers after they suffered an electrical shock or got hit by lightning in some cases. There are many of these stories, and the guy who very generously wrote the foreword for our book is named Dr. Larry Dossey, who has a book out now on, it's called The Power of Premonitions.
And he's been on my program, by the way.
Yeah, he's a terrific person, and a very warm very warm person, as he is, as you must also know, a very gracious person, and knows a lot. And he studied this, and when we were talking about it way back when, he said, yeah, the idea of someone gaining healing abilities by being struck by lightning has an old history going back to, I guess, tribal cultures that are associated with shamans. You know, religious figures in one of those communities, sort of out of the way now. But the shamans were people that had this ability to heal, and of course there are therapists today, somatic therapists and others who it's their livelihood. They lay on hands. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but there are experiments, some of which we mention in the book, where the energy level that they produce is actually discernible, mm-hmm. And much more so than standard therapists. There have been experiments where psychologists or psychiatrists who do talk therapy are measured in the same way as the folks who are healing touch practitioners, for example. And there are differences physiologically in the output of energy, and people can evidently feel this, you know. And of course, there's also acupuncture, which has an ancient history going back thousands of years in China and that part of the world, and no one even now knows exactly, although it's been extensively studied, how precisely acupuncture works. But there appear to be, junctures in the body where, if you picture the energy as water, as a stream flowing energetically through the body, the acupuncture points evidently either can slow it down or speed it up, and that seems to facilitate healing. So that there is an energy body, according to many traditions, and that if you can manipulate the energy body, so to speak, then you can facilitate healing.
Mm-hmm. I can put my hand on a, and maybe this is physiological, but I can put my hand where someone's been injured or say they have back problems, and I can feel the heat where that problem is without them telling me where it's at. And that tells me that there's something generated within the body that you could feel that people have. And I'm sure people with the ability to heal would have that sensitivity to that.
I have to say I'm quite jealous, because I've talked to people, Linda. You're the latest, and so it's fascinating to me when people say that they can do that. I have no doubt that they're describing something real. It's just that standard neuroscience right now, which is kind of writing the book on what it is to be a human being, more so than religion or philosophy, which mm-hmm. have sort of taken a back seat. It's the neuroscientists who sort of have the glamour job these days of writing, you know, what it is to be human. But they don't really get it, because they're not the medical intuitives. They're not the empaths so much. They live in their head. They study the head. They study the brain. And so there's a real disconnect between the people who are writing the science of the brain and sort of believe, well, the body just sort of follows the brain around like a servant yoked to its master, and the rest of us who perhaps have a greater degree of sensitivity to our bodies, and you in particular, who, you know, can feel energetically what's going on with other people. And so there's this gulf between neuroscience and people who understand that we're much more unified creatures. It's not just the brain and the body, it's all connected, but have a particular ability which to date neuroscience hasn't really been able to get a handle on. And what our book is trying to do, Dr. Mukozzi and I are trying to bridge that gap with this book. It hopefully will appeal to folks who are sensitive and who understand that the mind is not just the brain. You know, the mind is the entire body and the feelings that connect us all up. But hopefully there's enough science in there to explain some of this, some of the energetic aspects of what's been called the paranormal, that it would give the folks coming from a scientific angle something to go on, and they hopefully could see that there's a connection between some things that maybe are slightly understood now, whether it's allergy or migraine headache or chronic fatigue, PTSD, stuff that really is getting some scientific scrutiny, and all this other stuff that you know very well, it's genuine, but it just hasn't sort of been accepted by mainstream science.
Mm-hmm. And I, this is why your book is so wonderful. I've told a lot of people about your book, and when I was promoting this interview today, I shared it with a broad spectrum of different types of people, and the response I get is, they know there's something there. People know that there's this thing with the sixth sense. They know that there's an energy that's exchanged, but they don't understand it, but they know it's there. And it's about time people and doctors and the medical profession started acknowledging this and started studying this. And I think this is why this book is groundbreaking, because it takes it all and puts it together in a book and say, let's think about this. Let's think about maybe it's manifesting this way. Maybe this is the connection that we have. You have in your book that we've all heard about mothers who sense something that, like the child, something wrong with the child. This last week I had an emergency situation for myself where I had to be taken to the hospital, emergency, and I got two calls from friends that I actually had not thought about for a while. They called me and said, are you okay? Is something happening? Is something happening to you? Two people called me just out of the blue, and they said they felt something was wrong. And that, just some simple little thing that happened in my life just this last week, there's something out there that people need to start looking at. And it can be scientific. It doesn't necessarily have to be woo-woo. It's just that nobody's really looked into it because they classify it over here on a shelf as something that we cannot connect all these things to, but there's something there.
Right, and it's, first of all, I'm glad to know that you recovered, and second of all, that people were somehow, you know, tuned in to be able to make those calls to you. And there are so many examples of that. We have 7 case studies that we report on in the book that are pretty well documented. One of those, of course, is of a woman who was on the East Coast, and at exactly the time as her daughter was being hit by a vehicle while she was walking across a bridge. She was a college student, it's fine, but at the time she was hit by a car and basically thrown a good distance and injured significantly. Her mother, who was attending with her husband attending a committee meeting 3,000 miles away on the East Coast, got up and said, Harry, something's going on with our daughter. And that was actually recorded in the committee minutes. So, you know, some of these are captured for the record. That was actually taken from a book by Larry Dossey. But there are many examples, and not all of them have to do with people. There are also examples of animals who react to the people that they live with when someone is severely injured, when someone is dying. There are examples of dogs and cats acting peculiarly as if they understand that there's something wrong, and it seems to be not exactly connected with maybe body language that they might be picking up from other family members. They don't really have a way to gauge based on what they're seeing or hearing in the normal way, but nonetheless they seem to be reacting to something going on with people that they care about and are used to living with. Rupert Sheldrake is a British biologist who's written extensively on this. The most well-known book that he's done about this is called Dogs Who Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. And he's actually studied extensively videotaped dogs who seem they get all perky when their human is within a certain range and has sort of made a determination to come on home after spending the day at work or wherever they're going. And it's fascinating because it's been called a primary form of consciousness, or sort of a basic awareness that we don't know exactly where it comes from. Some people would call it a gut feeling, an intuition. It's definitely a feeling that makes itself known. And that's our contention in the book, is that if you look closely at the neurobiology of feelings, how the feeling stream, if we stay with that analogy of feelings as water, how the water flows and what makes up the water and where the water goes, then we potentially have a way to understand what's happening. Although how it's transmitted, which it seems to be, is a real challenging nut to crack. One author, his name is Michael Fox, he's a veterinarian, has a column on animals, I guess, that runs in many papers across the country. He's called it the empathosphere, which is a wonderful phrase, you know, empathy, that animals seem to have for other animals and for people. And it's sort of a primary form of awareness that comes through that some of us have greater access to than others.
That is so true. You know, my husband died of cancer in 2003, and he was home under hospice care. And when he passed away, our dog howled, and he was in the backyard. Our dog was in the backyard. So there, and then it was like they knew when the time was coming. And I just think there's so much truth to that. I've seen it firsthand. What about people that have near-death experiences? And I've done a lot of programs on that. They seem to come back changed, or they seem to come back energized with a new, let's view it as a conduit for this energy to flow more frequently between people and into them and out of them. What is your studies on near-death experiences discovered?
We haven't done any studies ourselves, but we certainly quote a number of studies. There are
folks, you research then.
Yeah. I just want to make it clear. Yeah, we did our own research. There are two chapters in the book that are all about extraordinary sensitivities, and so we have done that research. The rest, the chapter that you're mentioning on out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences, might be one of the most interesting in the book. And I'll quote one probably fairly recent episode that we cite. It's taken from a book by Oliver Sacks called Musicophilia. It's his latest book. Oliver Sacks is the New York neurologist who did a book years ago called Awakenings, which turned into a movie with Robin Williams, and so is one of the more well-known neurologists. But he examined a patient named Tony Sicoria, who is a surgeon in New York State, and he was evidently making a phone call one day a few years ago, and he was outside struck by lightning. And not only did he have, Linda, a near-death experience where, you know, he apparently was looking down on his body and seeing himself resuscitated, and then he said, "I felt just slammed back," and then he was in a whole lot of pain, and he was back in his body, which is quite remarkable in and of itself. But shortly thereafter, he started hearing music, and not just Muzak kind of music. He was hearing remarkable music that he didn't know where it was coming from, and he couldn't turn it off. And he had taken piano lessons as a child, hadn't really taken. He didn't consider himself a musician, but he went back to relearn music and started taking piano lessons and teaching himself or being taught composition because he felt he needed to write out this music. And so there's a spasm of creativity and, like, again, sort of the water analogy, a faucet that was just pouring out, and he wanted to try and capture it. Well, today, I think he's kept his day job, but you can, I believe, download or buy music by Tony Sicoria, which he probably wouldn't have written if he hadn't been struck by lightning and had a near-death experience. And I asked a woman named P.M.H. Atwater.
Yeah, I've had her on quite a number of times.
Then you know her very well. She's probably the authority when it comes to near-death experiences and the paranormal. And I asked her, "Is this unusual, what Sicoria went through?" And she said, "No, not at all. People," because she's done polls, she's done studies, and she had precise numbers on it's not infrequent that people have near-death experiences and they hear this most amazing music. They may not come back like he did and have difficulty turning it off and have to compose it, but it gives them some degree of reassurance because it tends to be very nice music, and it calms them down and they feel less stressed and fearful about dying.
Fascinating. We're getting to the top of the hour. We have about two more minutes, and we've been talking to one of the authors of the book, The Spiritual Anatomy of Emotion, How Feelings Link the Brain, the Body, and the Sixth Sense, with Michael A. Jauer. He's been with us today. Also, Mark S. McCosey. He's an MD and a PhD. He also co-authored this wonderful book, and we've just skimmed the surface. By no means have we got into the meat of this book, and that's what my goal was today, is to skim the surface of this book and present it to you, and then the listeners out there, and you can go get this book and read about it and discover so many more things. It's one of my favorite books I've done, actually. Well, how can we find out more about you? We have a few minutes. I want to give you a chance to give your email or whatever you'd like to give out.
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, Linda, speaking for both Mark and myself, we appreciate your enthusiasm about a book a great deal, and we're especially glad that it's you found it useful. That's another, probably the major reason that we wrote the book, is that a lot of people who, like you, are sensitive in a variety of ways, have been looking, maybe if they didn't know, but they were looking for some way to sort of size up the sensitivity and realize that there's a scientific basis for it, even we haven't figured out 100%. But by looking at feelings and how feelings work in the brain and the body, it gives us a handle on stuff that we know exists, but it's just not clear exactly how it works. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the website is www.emotiongateway.com, Emotion Gateway, and that's because emotion really, in our view, is a gateway to understand a whole lot of things, including anomalous occurrences and experiences that people have. And Mark's email and my email are in the website. All people need to do is look under the, I guess there's a tab called the book, and then there's a tab called other information, and you can find out, you know, download excerpts of the book, see the table of contents, and of course get contact information on us. And for that matter, download the sensitivity survey if folks would like to take the survey and be part of the database.
That's wonderful. I also like to encourage you, if you're in Salt Lake City, to go to the Golden Braid. They have the book on order. And I actually think they have it in stock because I told them to get it in. That was about 2 weeks ago. So go to the Golden Braid if you live in Salt Lake City. That's your little corner bookstore. And please support them because they're trying to survive. And I love the little bookstores that are here and there. Thank you so much, Michael Jauer, for being with us. The Spiritual Anatomy of Emotion. Thank you.
Linda, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Linda Strasberg, interviews and interactions on K-Talk. AM 630, KTKK.